In this week's program, a book by a leading musical conductor about what his profession entails. Leonard Slatkin is the music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and the Orchestre National de Lyon. Other positions he has held were with orchestras in St. Louis and Washington. He was conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra for 4 years. With me, John Hughes, formerly a producer with RTE's Lyric FM. He's an organist and conductor. Fiona M. Palmer is professor and head of NUI Maynooth's music department. As well as being a musicologist, she's both a singer and an instrumentalist. Kevin O'Connell is a composer who has had numerous commissions from RTE and the BBC. He's head of composition at the Royal Irish Academy of Music and writes regularly for the Musical Times. John Hughes, what did you make of Leonard Slatkin's book?
Absolutely marvellous read from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. It took me a while occasionally to get used to the Americanisms, which I would call them. Something like such and such a person was slated to appear at a concert.
Oh, yes.
And I said to myself, that's not fair. He hasn't even done the concert yet. But naturally, I've got to understand the jingle, the words he used. Yeah, it's marvellous. It's well constructed. He quotes somebody at the beginning saying, every book has a beginning, a middle and an end. But not necessarily in that order.
Right.
And that's exactly what it is. There's occasional to-ing and fro-ing, but he keeps each chapter absolutely concise and precise and concentrate on the subject of the chapter.
Fiona, how did you respond to it?
I enjoyed it very much in many ways. I thought that it was really refreshingly unpretentious and quite honest about how his career had progressed and where he came from and so on. And I thought that it would be a particularly useful read for a student who was thinking about moving into the world of conducting, but that it would also be very interesting to anybody who goes and attends orchestral concerts to get some insights into the life of the conductor.
And Kevin O'Connell, what did you think?
I enjoyed the book very much. I think it's a rare first-hand glimpse into an activity that everyone sees when they go to a concert, but they don't particularly understand what conductors do. Most of us don't. And you find out in this book a lot at first hand about the nuts and bolts of the activity. A conductor is an administrator. He or she is a psychologist. You have to handle a lot of people and sometimes quite difficult people. You have to be an expert in international flight schedules and so forth, all the unromantic bits of the profession. You find out about them here.
And you have to study the music, of course. Which is,
and he's very good, actually, on these technical nuts and bolts aspect. I mean, things that musicians will understand. You don't need a lot of technical knowledge to read this book. It's a book for the general reader. But transposing instruments, clefs, how you master an orchestral score. In fact, he has a chapter at the end of the book where he describes problem passages in some detail from very standard repertoire pieces. For prospective conductors, it's a very interesting read.
And he deals with things, John, like, should one listen to recordings? Conductive, that is.
Yeah. There are numerous schools of thought. Mind you, if you listen to performers by great artists, there's a danger you might learn something. And even at times, how not to do something. You know, you can say the opening bars of the Fifth of Beethoven that Kevin alluded to earlier. I've heard that described as a metrical minefield for many an aspiring conducting talent. And it's the most difficult opening, apart maybe from Don Juan of Strauss, but the Beethoven is worse because everything is in unison, strings and two clarinets. That's all that's playing those opening bars. There's no margin for error, none whatsoever. You have to be absolutely precise in when they're going to start, when they're going to move off the first note and attack the second group of the four notes. It's a nightmare to do.
Slatkin's point about recordings, Fiona, is that, fine, listen to recordings, provided you've digested the work, isn't that it?
It is. Yes, and I think this is another thing that really shines through his writing is he's clearly somebody who wants to share his knowledge. He really respects the people who mentored him, and he really wants to educate others and sees that very much and knows that that is part and parcel of being a conductor in today's world, that orchestras have to be involved in outreach and education, really, in order to survive. When he talks about recordings and so on, he is very, very clear that he underlines the point that everybody who goes out and stands centre stage in front of a large orchestra must have done an enormous amount of preparation, and that means really having the music in your body, as he puts it, by really looking at the structure, the overall structure, looking at the macro, micro levels and so on.
In other words, recordings could be dangerous, Kevin, if you really didn't know the work, isn't that it?
Indeed so, and he gives some hair-raising descriptions of recording pieces, basically on the back of a sight reading. And sometimes they turn out very well because of the nervous energy involved. But that chapter on recording was very interesting because anyone who has done recording with orchestras knows that in the final analysis, it's not the conductor, it's not the players, it's not the composer himself who is principally responsible for what comes out. It is the producer. He is the person, or she is the person, in the eye of the storm in the recording studio. And the main qualification is that you have to have ears as sharp as razors. Indeed, one of Slatkin's producers was called Razor Ears. That was her nickname. You have to be able to spot everything that goes wrong. And it's a very pressurised job. How performances, things that sound like performances, emerge from this process of cutting, pasting, rerunning, taking two bars where there was a wrong flute note, I just don't know. It's a mystery because it's like trying to reconstruct a mural by jigsaw puzzle method. That's how recordings are put together. But somehow great recordings do emerge from the process.
I know that he himself took up the piano and the viola. Is that a must or is it highly desirable for a conductor?
It is highly desirable, naturally. I mean, if one can master a string instrument to a good standard and play in an orchestra. Mm-hmm. I mean, someone like Charles Munch, who ended up as principal in Boston, he played in the Leipzig Gewandhaus with Furtwängler, and Furtwängler encouraged him to the conducting. So he came from within the ranks of an orchestra. A lot of conductors do. I'm thinking of Johannes Willner, and there are numerous conductors who played in orchestras. Rudolf Kempe, the oboist, he played in the Dresden Staatskapelle for years before emerging as a marvellous conductor. So yes, and then you're playing even in chamber ensembles. Somebody has to give a lead if you're playing in an octet or a septet. Somebody has to give a lead, and it's the leader of the group, either the first violinist. His father was a marvellous violinist, Felix Slatkin, the leader of the Hollywood Quartet, and his mother was the cellist, Eleanor Aller. So he came from a pedigree of highly qualified, wonderful musicians who were excellent in all forms of music, the cinema.
Speaking of the early years, he grew up in a Hollywood full of European emigres, so it was a very rich environment.
I actually found this the most fascinating passage of the book, is actually the first chapters, because it evokes an era that has now, not so long ago, but that has now disappeared. I mean, you imagine this kid is growing up in Hollywood in the 1950s. I mean, Schoenberg and Stravinsky visit. Frank Sinatra sings him and his brother to sleep at night. These are just people to him. He's not overawed by them. The one person he was overawed by, I believe, was Doris Day, because he was kind of in love with her, like half the males of the Western world, even when he was seven. But it's a fairy tale kind of upbringing. I mean, you could hardly make it up, really. But like a lot of fairy tales, it has a dark side. The father was workaholic and, as so often the case, alcoholic as well. And the young Leonard arrives home, I think at about the age of 16 or 17, to find his father lying dead on the bathroom floor. So there's a murky side to the story as well that obviously must have left its scars.
On the more directly musical side, Fiona, he talks about metronome markings at one point and how Samuel Barber refused to put them in on the grounds that moderato and vivace told the performers all they needed to know. Is that a view you share?
I think there are just so many ways of looking at that. That's one of those very contentious issues. And in a way, it relates to a point that he makes in the book and that other people who've written about conducting make, which is that every conductor has to find their own way of managing this side of things, the technicalities of things about how to set a tempo, find a tempo. And he writes particularly, when he's talking about how to use the metronome and or not use the metronome, he writes particularly about the preparation before the piece starts, which is something we always talk to performers about, especially young performers, about how one prepares, how you have to be in the mindset and feel the rhythm in advance, and then how you indicate that to the orchestra.
What's your own view on the matter?
I see the metronome as a very useful tool, but I think that one finds ways within the music of finding the tempo and sitting in the tempo.
John?
it can be very misleading. I remember doing a piece by Gerard Victory, a lovely piece, a wonderful composer, and we were recording and I rehearsed it and I said, Jerry, is that okay? It's very slow, John. Oh. Yes, I said, but it's faster than your metronome. And he looked at it. He put down a crotchet to 60 instead of a dotted minim to 60, which meant I was doing it a shade faster than half the speed it should have been at. So metronomes, with care.
Absolutely.
One thing that Slatkin is very strong on, Kevin, is the idea that all budding maestros should try their hand at writing music. They should have some feeling. I take it that's a view you'd share.
Very strongly. Mm. If you look at the founding fathers, as it was, because they were mainly male, of modern conducting technique, the names that come up are Mendelssohn, Berlioz, Wagner, Strauss and Gustav Mahler. Now, they all have one other thing, striking thing in common, apart from being conductors. In fact, they all treated conducting as a hobby. Their primary activity on earth was to create music. Now, we now have division of labour. Within professional music circles, everybody does one thing to a very high degree. But what Slatkin is saying, I was very struck by this passage. The only way you can understand the confrontation with the blank page is to do it.
And do many conductors try, John? I mean, is it rare? I would have thought it... It is.
Mazel, I know, has written music. The great conductors of the past did. Furtwängler wanted to be a composer first and foremost and only took up conducting because nobody else would do his music. So what did he do with his own piece? Bruckner's Ninth Symphony. So, I mean, there was a brave choice. Klemperer composed.
Boulez and Bernstein as well.
Exactly.
But I take it the thinking, Fiona, here is that it's a way, if you really want to understand music, try to get into the mind of the writer.
Absolutely, and he does make the point that a conductor is a recreative artist and that understanding then the act of original creation is very important, and unless you've done that from the inside and tried to manipulate the syntax and so on yourself, then you don't have those insights that the composer would have.
It's extraordinary for a man of his experience. There's a lot of what I would call gratuitous advice here. You know, like, if there's a soloist involved, you need to meet them in advance. Gee. in a foreign country, it helps to know a few words of the language. And then, best of all, a dress rehearsal is, of course, not that literally. Oh, gee, Leonard, thanks for telling us. But I mean, this is quite amazing, isn't it? Surprising, John.
Yes, it is. It's very important, I think, to know the conditions and traditions of the people you're working with. And this could be the problem. To meet a soloist in advance, I think, is critical, because there are hair-raising moments in concertos where if you don't meet the soloist at the end of a certain moment, you're in dire straits. And in his little chapter on the 10 decision-making things that conductors have to deal with, he talks about the Emperor Concerto picking up a soloist at the end of a long run. Now, if you fail there and you bring the orchestra in early or late, you've destroyed the music. That's the worst thing you can do, apart from get the ire of the audience and the musicians.
But just imagine, Fiona, if the chemistry isn't good at that first meeting, you know, with the soloist.
Right? Well, he's very candid about that as well, because, of course, he includes the material about his unhappy experience at the Met in 2010 with Angela Georgiou.
Oh, yeah.
And he's very frank about that. And obviously he was a little bit too frank probably in the blog that he wrote too. But it is very much the case that he talks a lot about the psychology of the art of conducting. And as Kevin was saying at the beginning, he talks about the fact that a conductor has to be so many things to the players. But inevitably, his role is very much to give leadership. And if the orchestra decides collectively that they don't admire the conductor, which, as he says, an orchestra will do within a couple of minutes of meeting the conductor, that's the crucial time for any conductor, then really you're flawed.
It's a kind of savage assessment, isn't it?
It's Kevin. Brutal. One thing I will say as a composer is orchestras don't tend to like new composers very much because most composers are not Mozart, and we're new, and we're unfamiliar, and all that kind of thing. But when you're sitting in that pressurised situation of having a work rehearsed by a symphony orchestra that you've written, you can generally count on the idea that there is one person in the room that they still hate more than they hate you, and that's the conductor. The conductor is meant to be a kind of lightning rod for an awful lot of energy, some of it negative, and this is why it's not a profession for the faint-hearted. You've got to be tough as nails to survive in it.
I think Fiona hit on a point there with Slatkin at the Met. I feel, and who am I to comment like this, but to take on La Traviata at the Met, never having done it before, that I think was the big problem. He had never done La Traviata. He had a great debut at the Met with The Girl of the Golden West, but when he came to the Met, and even put on his blog, it's very dangerous to put things up there in public for people to read, to say that he's never done Traviata. The Met people are reading this. He walks into the pit not knowing, well, of course he'd know what he's doing, but never having done it before. And he's meant, as Fiona said, to lead the performance. How can you lead something you've never done? He really set himself up there for a difficult time.
Enlighten me on this struck me, but this premiere in Chicago, I'm wondering how much he makes of this. On the 7th of October 1976, of David Del Tredici's Final Alice. And for Slatkin, this piece is a watershed moment. I gather it's a neo-romantic piece that I haven't heard. I just heard an excerpt from it. Is he making too much of that, or is he making enough of it? What's your view?
I think he is, and again, it's very interesting.
You think he's right on...
No, I think that he's making too much of it.
Too much of it, right, okay.
You see, the thing is that... we think of music as an international language. It's not really. It's subject to the same sort of racial and stereotypical prejudices as every other human activity. And I find some of his estimates of American composers like Del Tredici and John Corigliano, shall we say, rather on the high side. I mean, I think that they're good composers, but I don't think they're great composers. He regards that event, that premiere of the Del Tredici piece, as one of the great events of the second half of the 20th
century. Does anyone else take that line?
I think, far outside of Chicago or the states around the Great Lakes, I'm aware of.
Yeah. What do you think, Fiona, of that? I mean, that he's really saying that it comes under the rubric of neo-romanticism, I suppose. In other words, the idea is that he cleared the way for other composers now to say, forget all those tonalists and serialists and so on, and that we can now go back to where we were.
Well, I would agree with Kevin that it seems to me that it seems to have been something that touched him particularly in a significant way, which he tries to bring out in the book.
Yeah.
But in terms of the canon of musical repertoire and so on, it seems over-egged to me.
So, and John, what did you think?
I would agree with that to a degree. His encounter with Elliot Carter, though, was a rather more significant one in a way, where Carter wrote this piece for three orchestras, and Slatkin wanted to present the piece to the audience verbally before he played the piece. Now, I've been at concerts years ago in Dublin, Brian Boydell with his amateur orchestra, and he'd start talking about Beethoven's overtures or whatever, and it was most illuminating to people who had never heard this music before, as you know. So you're listening to a complicated piece like the Carter for the first time. And I would have thought it would be in the composer's interest that this be done. But actually Carter walked out and the orchestra saw this man. They knew who he was. Slatkin saw him walking out. The audience wasn't sure. They'd never seen him before. Perhaps most of them hadn't. So that caused a major stir.
Carter changed his mind, didn't he?
He did indeed. Yeah. But the point was that he got recalled three times to take bows for the piece. Carter had gone, and when he presented it again without a speech, he got no recall at all. Maybe he got one.
Yes.
So it does help to illuminate the music.
How do you feel about that?
We just had Peter Maxwell Davis visit the Academy, and we were discussing this very subject, and Sir Peter said Beethoven didn't have to write a programme note for the Eroica Symphony, but the culture, for better or worse, has changed. People like pre-concert talks. They like explanation. I think so long as it doesn't go too far, because composers, if we could explain it all, we would be writers, not composers. I love the story about Franz Liszt. When someone asked him to explain a piece that he had just played, his response was to sit down at the piano and play it again without saying a word.
There's
a great truth in that story. But this Carter story is very good, and it's nice to say that it did have a happy ending.
It did.
Because about a year after that unfortunate episode, Carter needed someone to stand in to do the same piece with the New York Phil whenever the conductor fell sick. Slatkin was asked, and he said, "Why are they asking me?" And they said, "Well, because Elliot Carter recommended you. He thinks you do the piece very well."
And Carter agreed that Slatkin would do the premiere of his
Three Occasions.
Came out on the right side. I love that story about the lone percussionist falling asleep during the Dvorak cello concerto. That was one of these endless music festivals in America.
That's a wonderful story. I think he tells it terribly well. All his efforts to get the guy to be woken up. It happened Prangius Odin in Iceland. He was doing a piece and the cymbal player stood up with the cymbals watching the bars, but he wasn't to play in the piece. He wasn't to play, and he was all ready to clash the cymbals, and Prunches turned white, did all the gestures, and it resolved. It's nightmarish,
It can happen, I suppose, Fiona, that someone falls asleep. Not very likely.
I remember very well at one stage performing Walton's Overture to Portsmouth Point, and the double basses don't come in for a very long time at the beginning, as I recall, and my section partner had an aptitude for sort of dropping off, and I remember nudging him too early on purpose just to see what would happen, and he woke up and suddenly started playing.
Oh dear.
So it can happen.
You can never conduct, Sissy, enough Haydn or Schubert. Yes, you agree, Kevin?
Can I begin on that one at an oblique angle by saying that this book is refreshingly free of mentions of Gustav Mahler, because modern composers, conductors are obsessed with Mahler. And it's this kind of late romantic giganticism that has now come into orchestral concerts, with the result that people like Haydn, Mozart and the symphonies, and even Beethoven, are quietly disappearing from concert programmes. Mm. I think what he's talking about there is the conversational aspect of early classical music, that the instruments can hear one another, they can play like a string quartet. Mm. It's vital for them, for hearing the substance, the contrapuntal and harmonic structure of the music. I completely agree with him on that.
Well, what's the appeal of Mahler? Is it often extra musical in character?
I think it is. I just think that Mahler has now turned into... Mahler was the big novelty in the 60s because he had been neglected for so long. And so a kind of new form of plant life was introduced into the pond. My own feeling, controversially, is that it has now turned into an enormous weed that is sucking the oxygen out of the other life forms.
Fiona, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I would agree with Kevin that it is really refreshing that Slatkin, who has really harnessed, as he says, American and Slavic repertoires, but also that he appreciates the value of classical and early romantic music and so on, is very important, and it's a good thing.
When he talks about the myth of the longevity of conductors, I mean, Furtwängler went at 58, Bernstein at 72. Sorry, John, you don't agree.
He's wrong there. Yeah. Furtwängler died at 68.
Yes. 68,
he robbed him of 10 years.
Those 10 years make a difference. But in fact, Toscanini, Giulini and Stokowski were in the 90s, so still holds, doesn't it? Yes.
It does. Apropos of Haydn and Schubert, the story with Jean Morel at
Juilliard,
conducting a Haydn symphony, and his left and right hands were mirroring each other. They simply mirrored each other. And Morel says, you could have left half of you at home.
There's a certain mirroring of the Leonard Bernstein career, isn't there, in terms of the stand-in moment. With Bernstein, it was Bruno Walter.
Yeah, it's a nightmarish thing to do. If you know the repertoire you're being dropped into, that's fine. Prokofiev 5, he knew well. The Waverly Overture of Berlioz, he didn't know, and he never did it since. Standing in for Muti. That's right. But he knew the other piece, so he was on safe ground. It's when you're not on safe ground that's where the difficulties can be arise. Or you change a programme the way he did in London. Adrian Bolt was to do Job of Vaughan Williams. So he substituted the Job for the Symphony No. 6 of Vaughan Williams, which is, of course, a masterpiece. And that went down very well. So if you're on safe ground, there shouldn't be a problem.
Well, it is a moment, isn't it? It's often a dramatic moment in someone's career. It's the sudden call.
Yes, indeed. For everyone. I mean, Stravinsky's Firebird, another composer failed to produce a piece, and Diaghilev went to the young Stravinsky and said, can you have it in 3 months? And he said yes. So you have to be ready. You make your own luck to some extent. Yeah. And obviously that's what Slatkin did. In some ways, one could say perhaps it's been an unglamorous career, which is another interesting aspect of reading. I mean, it's been a highly successful career by the standards of 98% of conductors. But it's been BBC Symphony, it's been Washington, it's been Detroit. It hasn't been sort of Berlin, Chicago so much.
Yes.
But he loves music, and that's why he keeps doing it. And it's one of the reasons why this book, with some longer and some of the stylistic problems, which I agree, I think the book is hideously written, I've got to say. But for the story, and especially for young people interested in conducting or the music profession, some of it's very compelling.
Yeah, there are a lot of gems in it, aren't there, Fiona? Yeah. A lot of things you can...
Yes, I really do go back to what I said at first, which is that I do feel it's very genuine and it's unpretentious. And I think that's where its value lies. And like Kevin, I agree, there are all sorts of ticks in the writing that are, yes, are frustrating as one reads. But it is a good read, and I like, yeah, the honesty of it.
And for, yeah, John?
Yeah, I think he has some big problems. I mean, he does say in his chapter on the Traviata, "I am considered one of the best accompanists in the conducting world. This is not a boast." Well, now, if that's not a boast... then what is a boast? Mm. His time at the BBC, they wanted him out after 2 years.
They
wanted him out after 2 years. He was unfortunate at their last night of the proms, the week of September, the 9/11 disaster. Mm. He had to conduct that concert, and he threw out a lot of the music that was traditional. He made enemies there. He was written threats against him. There was a lot of objections to him. He took on the BBC, which is a kind of a hierarchy. He wasn't the music director. He was the chief conductor, and you did what you were told. He had to do music he didn't like, so he didn't endear himself to the British administration.
Nonetheless, you're recommending this book.
You oh, yes, read, yes, absolutely. It's a great read.
Yeah. And just also, by the way, a little nugget of information, that Koussevitzky, a rumour that he was unable to read a score properly.
That's true. Lucas Foss used to, he was the pianist in the orchestra, a very fine conductor. Foss used to play the piano, and he would put up the score, and Koussevitzky would conduct and Foss would play. So he would learn the music inwardly by ear. And good pianists are able to reproduce effects like legato, staccato, percussive sounds on a piano, which are a great help for a conductor.
We've been discussing conducting business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro by Leonard Slatkin. It's published by Amadeus Press. My thanks to John Hughes, Fiona M. Palmer and Kevin O'Connell. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie or on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.